thank you.
Welcome to Sunstone Session 365. In their arms and upon their shoulders, just when you thought it was unsafe to believe in the Book of Mormon, the Lamanites are mad as hell. Our presenter is Clifton H. Jolly, who is president of Advent Communications, a former journalist, BYU English professor, and church education system instructor. I'm sure skills from all of those will come into play today. And then we also have a respondent afterwards, Mark D. Thomas. He's a manager of N.D. Thomas Consulting, and he's also an author for Digging in Cumorah, Reclaiming Book of Mormon Narratives. Following both of these gentlemen, we'll have question and answer. I just remind you, please use the microphone since we're taping the session. And we will conclude at 4:30.
I've given, this is a paper by part. I gave the first part of it at the Sunstone Symposium in Texas, and then I was invited to, because they had the Los Angeles Times reporter who had reported on DNA evidence, which seemed to conflict with the Book of Mormon. They had him at the Sunstone Symposium in California, and so I was invited to present in response to his presentation, an event at which my wife said that I was so offensive that I made her feel sorry for the Los Angeles Times. And then I gave this paper, I gave the third part last year, and this is like the fourth part. And my family began by all of them attending the first parts, and they have fallen away one by one as the parts have become more tedious. My son, my eldest son Calvin, tried to not come today by calling me ahead of time and asking me if this paper would be any more coherent than the last three had been. On which I replied that I hope not. If it were coherent, I would be publishing it in the Farms Journal, not giving it some stuff. A young Havasupai Indian woman told her parents that she was marrying a Mormon and that he was white. Her mother was heartsick. The old woman said, "Bobo." I translated this brief story at the beginning from the Yiddish, and I don't know what Havasupai is or Papua, so she said, "Bobo, you know how hard the tribal elders and I have worked to get the United States to repay the $200 billion the government owes the Indian nations. You know what Indian givers the Mormons are, telling us we are a chosen people, then like all white men, taking it all back just because of the National Geographic Society and the DNA evidence indicating we came not from the near but the far east. Daughter, I don't want to be Chinese, and I don't want my grandchildren to be white." The girl was ready with an answer for her mother. She said, "My fiancé has agreed that we will our first child an Indian name." Well, her mother wasn't happy, but she was a little intrigued. It had been two generations since anyone in their family had given a child a traditional name that had not surrendered its names to the white oppressor. James Charlotte, if you're going to sit down, please. You're making me incredibly nervous to stand. And there's Jody. All three of them standing like sirens at the back, ready to steal the wax from my ear.
Hi. Somebody said, I suppose that if you were to give your children names in our tradition, your grandfather, man who fishes in the sacred water, would be pleased. So if you are so fortunate as to have a son, instead of a thankless daughter who will only break your heart, what will you name him? The daughter happily replied, Lehi Johansson. When I first proofed this paper with my wife, she accused me of being a racist for using the pejorative Indian Gibber, an accusation she did not entirely forgive when I told her the etymology of the term. Just as Jack Mormon wasn't originally associated with a bad Mormon, but with a Gentile who was friendly to the Mormons, an Indian Gibber was not a slur originally of the Indians, but rather of the whites who could never keep their promises to the Indians, who never made a treaty that we did not break, who never gave land that we did not take back. Indian givers regret the gifts they give. We are Indian givers, and we're doing it again. We've begun the quiet process of retreating from our promises, of taking back our blessings, of regretting our missionarying and our Indian lesson plans, and the presumption of thinking we know who Indians are and which book is the history of their ancestry. Years ago when I visited Tulum, the only Mayan city temple known to be built on the coast, I was approached by a young Mexican who offered to give us a historical tour. After bickering over the price, I agreed to the tour, and he said, great, my name is Nephi Flores. Thinking that in a moment of religious enthusiasm I had misunderstood him, I asked him to repeat his name. Flores, he said. No, I explained, with no intention to be ironic, your Christian name. Nephi, he repeated. And over there is my father, Lehi. When I told Nephi that I am a Mormon, he told me that many of the people in his village had Book of Mormon names, Alma, Jared, Samuel, Moroni, because a couple of effective missionaries had been through the town years before and baptized virtually everyone, telling them of the promises made to the Lamanites, of their royal lineage from Manasseh and the house of Israel. Not many of us still go to church, Nephi told me, but the names are good for business. Nephi then gave me what he described as the Mormon tour, pointing to baptismal fonts and glyphs of what appeared to be either horses or very large dogs, depending on whose archaeology you believe. My whole life, the archaeology I have believed is the one Elder Milton R. Hunter taught us to believe, that every pot or shard left by the Toltec, every glyph of the Aztec, every observatory of the Maya, is evidence of the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon and of the Lamanite ancestry of the American Indian peoples, every last one of whom used to be ordained one day to become white and delightsome, just like all of us here, with the possible exception of my daughter-in-law, who is part Japanese. I believe those stories fill, although the white and delightsome chapter has always troubled me a little. Not because it yields to that charge of racism with which my wife tries to tag me, but because of the imponderables. How would God do that? I mean, really, at the fundamental level of genetics. And would he make it retroactive, changing the chromosomes of all the Lamanites since Laman and Lemuel first rebelled, or just the chromosomes of Indians as we know them? And if so, would it be Indians living and dead? And if so, dead for how long? Considering the Shoshone, surely, maybe all the way back to when they first migrated from the eastern forests onto the Great Plains. But what about the Fremont people who lived in the Great Basin before the Ute? And before them, the Anasazi and the Kohonina people, who may have populated the southwest even before the Jaredites arrived to begin building all those ruins in the Yucatan. And assuming the National Geographic Society is right, that the bulk of these people are of Asian origin, will they also be made delightsome? Their skin's white, their eyes straight and round, just like ours. The questions compound, but only if you choose to believe the story that is the Book of Mormon. Many simply do not anymore. For if they do, they have saved their faith in the Book of Mormon by cutting loose the Indians, whose book it used to be. That seems to be the argument being advanced by Barnes, the Foundation for Ancient Research in Mormon Studies. The Lamanites may have been a relatively small group of people living in a very restricted area, say, on the Upper Weber in Kansas. This teensy-weensy speck of people has had their genetic material swamped by the yellow peril of Asian tribes who predated the peoples of the Book of Mormon by thousands of years and literally evidently filled the land. Although the writers of the Book of Mormon failed to mention any of them. Well, perhaps Mormon simply wrote them out in his condensation. Heavens knows, the Lamanites were keeping him busy. He couldn't get it all in. It was a small book. And God knows, Mormons still are ignorant of most of the earth's population. So perhaps the Nephites simply overlooked all of those Chinese scattered about. Because if you read most Mormon journals that are being kept in Orem, you'll wander through a lot of pages without reading anything about Darfur or the American Civil Liberties Union. And I'm stunned that Mormon scholars have so soon surrendered the debate to what is, after all, a monthly magazine. Evidently, I'm one of the only Mormon intellectuals who still knows the separate purposes of the Book of Mormon and the National Geographic magazine. The Book of Mormon is to teach us the power of myth to transform our societies and hopefully ourselves. The National Geographic magazine, on the other hand, serves the purpose for all neopubescents that it served for me, to teach them what black breasts really look like. Well, as I said at the beginning, I've now spoken a number of times on this subject, and to no effect except that the audiences get smaller. So today, in case any of you wish to escape, I want to warn you, I'm going to continue to talk about this until Mormon scholars stop cowering in the shadow of the genome research, accepting without argument the Chinese lineage of the Assiniboine and the Sioux, the Chippewa, the Cree, the Havasupai, and the Ute. Every year or so, publications such as the Los Angeles Times are permitted to blast the Book of Mormon with articles such as the one titled, "Bedrock of a Faith is Jolted, DNA Tests Contradict Mormon Scripture." In my last paper, I pointed out that for anything to jolt the faith at the bedrock, more Mormons would have to start reading. The result of all this hoopla about the genome, gone from general conferences are stories about the lineage of the Indian peoples and their birthright and their future blessing. Gone is the prophesying of that time when Native Americans will stand beside the house of Ephraim and be recognized as direct descendants of King David, of Isaac, and of Jacob. We no longer speak of blood atonement, or Adam God, or the white horse, or polygamy, or the three Nephites. In other words, we've abandoned the miracle. Because, once again, as in the past, We're simply running scared. And the ignominy of our retreat is worse than our failure to take responsibility for Mountain Meadows or for the purchase of the Salamander letter to archive it into oblivion. We have left the Indian nations to fight for themselves or to be subsumed by science, as we seem to assume the Book of Mormon has certainly been. We argue otherwise, but our arguments are always, forever, at the expense of our brothers and sisters, the Lamanite remnant, all the tribes of the American Indian nations, and the mestizos of Mexico, and the natives of the jungle south, and the aboriginals of the frozen tundra north. But just when it looked like it was safe for scientists to dismiss religious tradition as simply absurd, some of the Native American nations have come off the res to take up arms against anthropological presumption. And leading that dance of war are tribes that we don't usually think of as aggressive, such as the Inuit and the Havasupai. Anthropologists speculate that about 1350 AD, the Havasupai people began their migration into the Grand Canyon, where they remain to this day, their lands protected by one of the few treaties not broken by the United States, probably because it's so doggone hard to get down into the canyon to go about the business of treaty breaking. 1350 is about the same time the Fremont people of Utah were abandoning the Great Basin, probably because of drought and over-harvesting the limited amount of firewood and game in the valleys. The same trouble that most likely drove the Anasazi out of southern Utah more than a century before. Some believe the Kotomina people preceded the Havasupai into the Grand Canyon, perhaps as early as the submarine migration of the Jaredites to America. And the Inuit may have come across a land bridge from Asia as far back as 11,000 years ago. Probably, maybe, perhaps. There's a lot we're not certain of when it comes to early peoples, where they came from and when and why. But if you're an anthropologist, you get to speculate. You even get to name the people that you know so little about. Anasazi, Kunina. Just be sure that one of the names you give them isn't Lamanite. That's why Farms has spent so much ink and paper explaining why most American Indians aren't Lamanites after all. Their arguments are heavily footnoted, academically argued, if speciously so. But the result is pretty much the same every single time. Jettison those troublesome Indians. Take back the promises we made, the stories we told. They aren't who the prophet said they are, except maybe at South American temple dedications. When I'm told they remain to be Lamanites. In Peter Shaker's Passion play, Royal Hunt of the Sun, the Inca god King Atahualpa, whom Francis Pizarro commits to death by garroting, replies to Pizarro's boast that the Catholic Church is the one true faith and the Christian God the only God. Atahualpa says, "I have seen what you do to your God. You cut him into little pieces and you eat him." I first saw the play performed, of all places, in the mid-1970s at Brigham Young University. It was a wonderful performance, directed, if I remember correctly, by the late Carl Malden during one of his summer workshops at BYU. And at that point at which Atahualpa reduces the Catholic sacrament of the Eucharist to its horrific transubstantiational fundament, the BYU audience howled. They cheered to have a romantic pagan skewer the great and abominable church. What the audience failed to grasp is that Schaefer isn't after just the Catholics. He's out to get all of us. The unlettered, superstitious masses of Christianity who fail to appreciate the beauty and natural genius of a native religion whose only excess was its belief that the gods can be appeased by cutting out the still beating hearts of children. A similar naivete is exhibited in the several issues of Farm's Journal responding to the Human Genome Diversity Project, sponsored by the National Geographic Society and intended to determine the origin of American Aboriginals, Amerindians as they're sometimes called. And more recently, Barnes has taken up to responding to the evangelicals who naively attempt to discredit the Book of Mormon by references to that DNA research. Barnes Journal editor Daniel Peterson points out that the data cited by the evangelicals discredits not only the Book of Mormon, but also a liberal evangelical reading of the Bible. If you accept the theory that Asians migrated to the Americas over a Bering Strait land bridge, you should not leave out the fact, as evangelical critics of the Book of Mormon always do, that the migration had to take place more than 11,000 years ago, before the land bridge was submerged again into the rising oceans. That means that the migration was taking place several thousand years before fundamentalist Christians believed that the world was even made. Those clever Chinese. What Peterson himself seems slow to understand, or wants not to know, is that the same facts that nail the evangelicals also pin us. You can't cherry-pick your science or your history, and Barnes does both, in an effort to protect its legacy as the foundation of ancient research and Mormon studies. Mormon meaning the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, meaning the Book of Mormon, but evidently no longer meaning the people of that book. At least not the people we thought were the people of the book, the people we promised, the people I promised on my Northern Indian mission to be the people of the Book of Mormon. Peterson writes, the editor's introduction of the Farms Review, Volume 15, Issue 2, the issue includes a roundtable of reviews and writing and research seemingly intended to explain or to confound the trouble created by the National Geographic Survey of the Amerindian genome, and to do it whatever the cost. You don't have to read the articles to get the point, just the titles do the trick. Historicity of the Latter-day Saint Scriptures, you bet. Mapping the Book of Mormon, a comprehensive geography of Nephite America. Prolegomena to the DNA articles, is that the right pronunciation? Those social scientists. Detecting Lehi's genetic signature, possible, probable, or not. Nephi's neighbors, Book of Mormon peoples, and pre-Columbian populations, and the list goes on. Peterson presents his introduction as refutation of what he believes to be, quote, the suppression and abuse of true science and history, close quote. In other words, science and history, which finds itself in agreement with the Book of Mormon. It's a long essay. It has 99 footnotes. From it, I've culled two paragraphs, widely separated in his essay, which I'm going to read as a single statement, and I think that in spite of the ellipses, Brother Peterson would agree with the following as an accurate summary of his thesis. Some have claimed that those who advocate a limited geography for the Book of Mormon, read Camus, that is, who argue that the Jaredites, Lehites, and Mulekites were not alone in the Americas, are fighting a desperate rearguard action against the advance of archaeology and now of biological science. These critics' marked irritation with contemporary defenders of the Book of Mormon often extends beyond these and other particular issues to the entire enterprise most prominently represented by the Foundation of Ancient Research and Mormon Studies. Imagine that. If DNA research demonstrates that the hemispheric or global theory of the Book of Mormon, according to which every pre-Columbian Amerindian from the Bering Strait to Patagonia and from Hudson's Bay to the Amazon was a pure descendant of Lehites and the Lehites alone, is untenable, that too is good. In other words, if the Indians aren't Lamanites, that's a good thing. It will serve to illustrate the power of science to assist solid or earlier scholarship in sharpening and making more accurate our understanding of the world around us, in somewhat the same way that continuing revelation helps to clarify our understanding of the truths of the gospel, which of course explains why revelation no longer talks about the Indians disproved by DNA research. That was my answer, not his words. It will not only be consistent with, but will be supportive of careful readings of the Book of Mormon that have been available for many decades. It will merely eliminate popular assumptions, sincerely held, well-intended, but external and foreign to the scriptural text, that had attached themselves to the Book of Mormon in much the same parasitical and distorting way that Aristotelian criticism attached itself to the Bible. Well, bully for Brother Peterson. And too bad for Milton R. Hunter, whose New World Archaeological Foundation published photos of the glyphs and architectural features of Maya and Inca temples, reported to be baptismal fonts and horses and Jesus Christ himself. But that was back in the day. Back before Brother Peterson explained how the opinions of the people who believed Elder Hunter were victims of popular assumptions that, while sincerely held and well-intended, are, as he said, external and foreign to the scriptural text. To quote Atahualpa, Elder Hunter's life's work and testament that the birthright of all the Native American peoples is of Manasseh and of the House of Israel is simply a false sacrament. Or to quote Brother Peterson, it is parasitical and distorted. I've said a lot of bad things about the brethren, but I've never said anything that bad. The National Geographic and Los Angeles Times now have taught us better than to believe the Book of Mormon or what the prophets had to say about it. But the Havasupai have not learned the lesson. When a genetic sample they gave to the University of Arizona to try to discover why they are plagued with diabetes was sent without the tribe's permission to the Genographic Project, the Havasupai sued. And they have good reason. The origin story of the Havasupai tells them quite emphatically that they cannot be descended from a prehistoric migration from Siberia because they are the first people. Gloria Ann Rawson of South Neck, Alaska, discovered from a testing of her DNA that she is not descended from the Aleuts, as a family tradition says, but from the Yup'ik Eskimos. So what you say? It shows how ignorant you are of the Yup'ik Eskimos, who are the traditional enemies of the Aleuts. What do you do with a story like that? Simple. You footnote it. Enough footnotes can make you forget or forgive almost anything. But tribes such as the Havasupai aren't buying it. Just as the Indian nations sometimes call themselves the First Nations, the half of the Supai know that they are the first people. Not just the first people in the Americas or the first people in the Grand Canyon, but the first people, period. So when the National Geographic Society came into the canyon wanting cheek swabs to find out who the ancestors of the Havasupai are, the Havasupai said, "Ixnay," because the Havasupai know that they are their own ancestors. They will always know it, because the story is kept sacred and true on the walls of the canyon, where they have kept themselves and their story safe since the beginning of time. And if you can read the rock, this is the story it tells. There are two gods of the universe, Totopa, the god of light, and Hokomata, the god of darkness, who some call a prince. Hokomata wagered with Totopa, and when he lost, as he always did, he again became angry, but this time he threatened in his rage to drown the world. Well, this made Totopa very unhappy, because he had made the world for his favorite daughter, Pukehe, from whom he had hoped would one day descend the human race. But Hokomata persisted in his wickedness, and Totopa resigned himself to saving Pukehe, even if he could not save the world. So working day and night, he prepared the trunk, he prepared a pinion tree, hollowed out the trunk, and saved it for his daughter. In this hollow tree, he placed food and other necessaries and carved a window so his daughter could see when the rains had stopped and the floods receded and light come again into the world. Totopa then sent Pukehe into the tree, sealed her up, and sat down to await the destruction of the world he had made and the defeat of his hope for mankind. Soon the floods came, making more noise than 1,000 Hakataias, which is the first name of the Colorado River, uncovering all the earth with water. But the pinion log floated, and in safety lay Pukehe, while the water surged higher and higher, covering the tops of Puhenavacha and Huehagopola, the tallest mountains of the world. Hokomata's storms were terrible, but no bad thing, the Havasupai know, lasts forever. The rain could not always be descended. Hokomata's floods could not always shut out the sun from the world. After many days, the rain ceased, and because the water could not balance itself at the top of the mountains, it ran away, and in a low place it made the ocean. As it dashed down the tallest mountains in the world, it cut through the rocks of the plateaus and made Chi'amimi Hachateya, the Grand Canyon, which is where Pukehe's log came to float at the very bottom in the sacred waters of the Havasu. The flood had lasted so long that the girl who had gone into the pinion emerged as a woman who sat in the twilight and began to make the pottery and baskets she had learned from Totopa. But although she had much work to keep her busy, Pukehe was now a woman, and she longed for a child in her arms nursing at her breast. But there was no man in all the universe. Pukehe was, after all, the very first person. So she spent her days in darkness, digging clay, firing pots, weaving baskets, and longing for a child. Until one magic morning for Pukehe and the Havasu race, in the far east, a new star appeared, which became brighter and brighter until it became the sun, coming as the final conquest of Hokomata's long night. Nearer and nearer the sun came, washing away the darkness from the far mesas and falling over the rim of Chi'amimi Hakataya and into Pukehe, who conceived and bore a son, in whom she delighted and called Inya'a, which is son of the sun. And again, Pukehe longed for a child, this time going to Wahatapikahata, the sacred water that still falls into the Havasu Springs. And this time she conceived a daughter. And to this day, all the girls of the Havasupai are known as daughters of the water. These two children of Pukehe marry and are the parents of all the human race. First the Havasupai were born, then the Apache, then the Hualapai, then the Hopi, then the Paiute, and the Navajo. And Tochopa told them all where they should live, but the sacred canyon he gave to the Havasupai, the first child of Pukehe, the first people in all the world. If you do not believe these words, you can see them above the dancing place, where on the walls can still be seen the pictures of Pukehe and Ahaha, to remind the Havasupai from whom they are descended, and to warn them against false stories and cheek swabs. Hokomata, by the way, continues his mischief to this very day. In olden times, he tempted the Apache to violate the canyon, the sacred canyon. And from time to time, he encourages other violations, such as stories that are not true, and the University of Arizona and the National Geographic Society. But the Havasupai know that their story is safe, written in the stone, high above the dance place, where the hand of Hokomata no longer can reach. Those of you who remember your seminary stories and those transparently golden LPs on which were recorded the conference sermons and BYU addresses of Elder Hunter, describing the ruins and records in Central America that prove the Book of Mormon, you will be inclined to hear in the Havasupai story unmistakable echoes of familiar stories more recently told in the Bible and the Book of Mormon. Those of you who are scientists or otherwise skeptical, the anthropologists and geneticists and directors of the National Geographic Society, will see tale types and archetypes common to many of the primitive peoples. I can't tell you what to think of our stories or how to believe them. What I can tell you is that any science or apologia of the faith that takes away the blessing from our Lamanite brothers and sisters, that is a discipline that returns Hokomata's night into the world and floods the earth again with rage and forgets the promises of Tochapa and the covenants we made to carry them, our brothers and our sisters, and to be carried by them now that we have lost the trick of believing. What I can tell you is that some of us no longer have ears to hear those stories. We no longer have eyes to see the magic that still is in the world. And we shouldn't be surprised, because this is what the prophets prophesied. This day is the reason why, when Joseph had finished with the golden plates, Tochopa wisely took them away. Had he not, we would have surrendered them for testing to the National Geographic Society. And worse, we would have been persuaded by the results, because we no longer wait upon the magic, but the science. We no longer see the miracle, but rather we insist that it be true. So, a Mormon, a Jew, and I have a soup, I walk into a bar. The Mormon orders a Coke. The Jew orders a cappuccino. The house soup, I orders nothing at all. And the Mormon says to the bartender, "I got a story to tell you, and it's a true story." And the Jew says, "I have a story to tell you, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but it's a really good story, so who cares?" And the Havasupai says, I have a story to tell you, and it's my story. Pray God that we can tell the difference in His name.
Today I feel a bit nostalgic. Today is a great day of blessing to be with you, my friends. And a blessing that you can't hear me. No better day than today to humiliate myself. Rabbi Clifton, I recall, the only time I met him was years ago when he gave a paper on Moroni. And I gave a paper at the same conference at BYU on Lehi's dream and Nephi's vision and an apocalyptic work. I don't know if you recall it. We've missed you. I've missed you. Thank you. For this blessing. But as Naomi Remen tells us, we were given more blessings than we received. He's told us today how to receive our blessings. And as the obscure scholar that I am, waiting in footnotes, I'd like to do one thing, and that is to look at the image he's given us. And that is the image of carrying the Gentiles carrying the Jews on their shoulders. Three samples of what this means. From 2nd Isaiah, an anonymous prophet that got it appended to Isaiah, almost certainly. Let me read it to you. If I can find it. These are the words of the Lord God. I shall beckon to the nations and hoist my signal to the peoples, and they shall bring your sons in their arms, and your daughters will be carried on their shoulders. You can see this, little kids, not young, with their arms around your neck. Kings shall be your foster fathers. Their princesses serve as your nurses. They will bow to the earth before you and lick the dust of your feet. You will know that I am the Lord. None shall look to me. Who look to me shall be disappointed. This is from a prophet in exile. And I recall Jack Adams from the University of Utah teaching Bible literature. He gave the spirit of this second Isaiah. He read from Isaiah 35, and I won't read it. But it talks about a causeway in the desert, a place where the lame would walk and be able to walk, where there would be no tears, where there would be no crying. And all would go on there, and this way of holiness would be blessed to return to Jerusalem. And I recall that now because he had tears in his eyes and he said, I wish I could believe this. That's 2nd Isaiah. An image of hope where the nations would carry your children back home. A poem of hope, an image of hope. The Book of Mormon takes this same image. In the end of 1st Nephi and the beginning of 2nd Nephi, and turns it into an allegory of the last days, where the Jews would be restored to their promises, all the Jews, including Native Americans. And he takes it quite literally, as an allegory. Each piece means something. It's a piece of the puzzle. It's not an image that means one thing. It's a puzzle where each puzzle piece is part of this grand allegory. For example, the licking of the dust of the feet is those who have offended God. The Gentiles or the enemies of the Jews would be humiliated. So there you go. Each piece means something. It's a big giant puzzle in the Book of Mormon. Finally, what we've heard today is an image turned on its head. No longer do we need kings and princes and the presidents to help us. We're carrying each other. Native Americans carry us and we carry them. And I think he's twisted the image in a way now. The purpose of a good image, who was it? The French philosopher said, a symbol is intended to provoke thought. And what this has done is provoke thought on how we can receive our blessings. It is not so much of dreaming that you're someone that you aren't, a grand person lifting you. It is not so much you lifting someone else, but it's a reciprocal act of blessing. So how do we receive our blessings? If we help each other as equals. There was not a Lehi that left Jerusalem and came to America. And yet, Lehi crosses to America every day. Every day. So I'm so grateful to be here. It's a blessing to hear you. And I hope that you come again and speak to us. It's wonderful. I miss your articles in the paper. And I see my friends, you here today, and honor you, and have received blessing from you, and hope that I somehow might give some blessing in return. All I can say is that I will remember this day for the rest of my life. I will remember you. Thank you. And I wish I had the pen of Shakespeare when he called the troops into battle. Years to come, but I will brag to my grandchildren that I was in your presence. So in this grand case, I hope that we can be guided by the light of science and inspired by the music of religion. Thank you.
Feelings of the heart that you've presented, but I'd like to present another way to look at this from the point of view of science. And to do that, I'd like to make sure we understand what science really is. There is a misconception that science is the process by which we explore and discover truth. That couldn't be further from the truth. Science is the process by which we eliminate error, not discover truth. So science never lives up to its ultimate goal. It can't. If you can't find error, you can't perceive the truth. And the reason is because we always look at the world from an incomplete point of view. Now, physics, I'm a physicist. Physics is supposed to be the king of sciences, in collaboration with the queen of science, mathematics. What could be better than to have mathematics on your side? You can't make mistakes if you have mathematics, can you? Nothing can be further from the truth. We didn't even know what heat was until Clausius told us in the last century. There was no first law of thermodynamics until Clausius came along. We didn't understand the second law of thermodynamics until Clausius helped us that view. Now, in the church, we have a tradition of trying to bring science and spirituality together. And I think we have advantages in doing that. I think this is an example here where if we hang in there with spiritual insight, and following what science really is, eliminating error, I think we'll get there. I think some of your predictions will come true. I think the DNA arguments will be put in perspective. I'd like to make fun of physics for a few minutes here, because physics is held out as the, like I said, the king of sciences. On the turn of the century, our apostles, who were scientists, Talmage and Witzel, couldn't understand what was called then the great heat. The universe is running down. If the universe is running down, then why do we teach that the gods organized the universe? They went to some place, took matter, and organized it, because they could only do it once. It would all run down, wouldn't it? It's a contradiction. Witzel understood that. He couldn't explain it. Well, we have the quantum mechanics of general relativity come along, and we got greater insight. A man named Fred Hoyle presented a solution to this. He called it the steady state theory, where matter was created uniformly throughout space, forever. It had gone on forever. And the 3-degree black body measurements were made at Bell Telephone Lab, killed the steady state theory. What came out of that was the Big Bang theory. And those that believe in creation, ex nihilo, crowed and said, "You Mormons, you're out of the picture now. And then problems came along with that. It was resolved by inflationary theory. That gave a possibility for creations to occur continually. Baby universes coming from parent universes. Then string theory came along to explain the particles. The founder of string theory, Leonard Zestein, has recently written a book where he's rejected string theory. String theory is not working. Okay, well, I'll stop at that point. So physics is in a quandary. Physics has found how to combine three of the forces, electromagnetism, the weak force, the strong force, but gravity refuses to be reconciled. And we as Mormons know about spiritual forces. It's a fifth force. I'm not impressed with what people who are not routine scientists, biologists, anthropologists, think they know about science. Thank you.
That's exactly what I meant.
I can't, being a former scientist myself, that bores me to tears. I can only think of Edwin Hubble's quote in his Nature of Science that I read long ago and I've never forgotten. The world of pure values, that world which science cannot enter, has no concern whatever with probable knowledge. Their finality, that is to say, eternal, ultimate truth, is earnestly sought. And sometimes, through the strangely compelling experience of mystical insight, a man knows beyond a shadow of a doubt that he's been in touch with a reality that lies behind mere phenomena. He himself is completely convinced, but he cannot communicate the certainty. It is a private revelation. He may be right, but unless we share his ecstasy, we cannot know.
That's what I meant. Is it more coherent?
It was slightly more coherent.
Thank you. Thank you. My son.
Thank you. I enjoy it very much, and I wonder, Carl Jung, in his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, wrote that that which we are can only be expressed by way of myth. And I've always been fascinated by the importance of interpretation that accompanies that statement. And I wonder if you'd remark on your position of our role as individuals, our responsibility to the interpretation of myth in our own lives versus the interpretation of that which myth stands against, and at what point we begin losing myth to fable.
No. I don't know. I think the key to it is what you said about the guy at the U who said that, I mean, I'm moved by any scriptural passage that has the lame walking, because I had polio as a kid. And so we are all moved by what moves us. But his point was profound when he said, I take it as an unbeliever, that he wished that he could believe that. That's the trick that Farms has lost. They no longer wish to believe in the myth. And I don't believe that faith is, what's his name said, a choice, a will to believe. I believe it's a gift. But there are things in our lives that we can choose to be, or we can choose against being. And too often in the church, we choose to support the church rather than one another. Too often, we choose the institution over ourselves, the family. We fulfill the prophecy that our institutions will become more important than the people that they are to serve. And part of the way that that happens is when we lose touch with that fundamental mythos, what I choose to call stories. The stories that we tell and by which we understand ourselves. There are stories that my children and I tell in our family. There are songs we sing. My wife is horrified when our son in Vietnam wrote back and was claiming some of her stories to be his own. He's already stealing from the family for his own necessities. We no longer trust to steal our own stories. We no longer trust. And I mean, I'm no great fan of Milton R. Hunter as a scholar. I mean, but for God's sakes, he was an elder in Israel. You can't simply throw him out with the bathwater. And the fact is that when you throw out these naive people who believe these naive stories, you do that. If the myth is to survive, you have to own the bad stories along with the good. You got to talk about polygamy. You can't simply pretend that it doesn't exist. You've got to watch Big Love every week. My wife and I do, subsequent which she refuses to speak to me for days. I'm from a polygamous tradition. I just found out that I'm not the child of the second wife, but the first, and I don't know why that disappoints me. But she doesn't come from that tradition, and she does, a long time ago. Abraham. She comes from that polygamous tradition. Evidently, if it's far enough in the past, it's okay. Another argument, I'm sorry. But in our society, We don't like the hard stories anymore. You know, Joseph, I was disciplined as a seminary teacher for teaching that Joseph Smith drank wine the night of that he was martyred. And I think it was John Taylor in his autobiography said that it wasn't to practice the sacrament. It's because our spirits were low. You've got to own that and understand it in some way if you're ever going to live the word of wisdom. You can't cherry pick